Hello and welcome to the Oldie podcast with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie. And in a world first, we've got an outside broadcast from Litchfield, Connecticut, with two distinguished political commentators, Philip Dells Broughton, formerly New York correspondent for the Daily Telegraph and a regular contributor to the Oldie, and Ivo Dorney, former Washington bureau chief for the Sunday Telegraph, who is covering the primaries in Iowa and New Hampshire. So, first of all, Phil, who's going to win the primaries and why?
Well, obviously, Donald Trump's going to win the Republican primaries. And then on the Democratic side, I think the big story so far has been the falling away of Joe Biden, former vice president. He was holding a lead for many, many months. And I think it's now become apparent as voters get to vote that they don't want him. And you're now looking at Pete Buttigieg, the former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, 37 years old, but could well capture this kind of centrist vote. And then it'll be him against one of the candidates from the left, one of these old senators, Warren or Sanders. And again, the Democrats have to kind of figure out whether they're ready for a real left-wing candidate to go up against Donald Trump or whether they want to choose something more youthful and dynamic and centrist.
And what about you, Ivo? You've been out in Iowa and you're about to go to New Hampshire. Who's going to win the Democrat primary?
I think it's still very early to say because we know that Mike Bloomberg is going to come in on Super Tuesday. The New York billionaire who is throwing money around like confetti, especially in the big states like California and Texas, which will have a major bearing on how the Democrat nomination turns out. Sanders is obviously running very strongly, but there's a very strong echo of Jeremy Corbyn there. There's a feeling that Sanders voters are very ideological and committed to his plan for a national health service, a sort of Europeanization of the United States. And there's also a very strong feeling among many neutral people that America isn't ready for his kind of politics yet.
And what do you think? I should have said that Philip Dells Broughton, having been brought up in Britain, now lives in Connecticut, so is plugged in. Can a socialist ever win in a modern America?
No. I think the idea is that a socialist candidate or very left, and Sanders is a socialist, certainly in the European sense.
It definitely is.
And it's a very unusual figure, even in American politics. He's an independent senator for many years, running as a Democrat. Elizabeth Warren is a more recognisable kind of left candidate. But no, I don't think a socialist can win. And I think they'll be made mincemeat of by Donald Trump. You've got a healthy economy, a strong economy, unemployment at real low. Young people seem to like a lot of what they're saying about universal healthcare, the rising cost of college. These are huge issues for people under 30. But it's not obvious they could carry someone to the White House.
And Ivo, you've been out on the road in Iowa. To our listeners, the caucuses and the primaries seem enormously complicated. Are they very complicated processes?
No, I think the great sort of mess of the Iowa caucuses was all to do with the app, which was meant to deliver the results to Iowan Democratic Party headquarters, which screwed up. Actually, I witnessed a caucus in a very small town of about 1,200 people, and I was rather moved by the whole procedure. It was a very interesting and very, very democratic process.
How many people were there in the room?
There were only 152 people who were in the room, and they divided into groups depending on who they favoured. And then after one vote, those who didn't achieve 15% of the total redistributed themselves after discussions with others to join the others and to make their choice. And I thought it was really impressive and linked in, I think, to the kind of town hall politics that would have happened in the days of the Mayflower.
And if you can explain to the listeners then what happens. So people stand on one side of the room, they then vote for one candidate or the other, is that right? Then it goes forward to the next primary, is that right?
There's one change. You affiliate straight away, or if you're not affiliated, you can sit out the first vote, and then you affiliate finally to whichever candidate you prefer. And if they've got more than 15%, those votes are totted up, and delegates are proportionately delivered to the county. Which will then, again, send their delegates to the state-level party. So it is a sort of proportionate system. I think the good thing about it, which you won't find anywhere else in any other of the primaries, is it compels the candidates to really get around the state. They can't just sit in the state capital and try and get the large population centres. They have to move around the state. And there's a joke in Iowa, which is that Iowans like to take their time and they like to meet all the candidates at least twice before they make their decisions. And it's almost true. I mean, at least two of the candidates visited all 99 counties in Iowa.
My God. And Phil, as somebody who's lived in both Britain and America and worked as a journalist in both countries, does it feel like a more democratic process, the voting of a president here, as opposed to voting of a prime minister in Britain?
Well, it certainly starts that way. I think, you know, why Iowa is so interesting is candidates spend months, as Ivo just said, going from fair to fair, knocking on doors. It feels almost like a British constituency election. It's the only time it really feels like that. New Hampshire a bit. And then after that, it becomes what they call sort of tarmac campaigning. It's just airports, the plane lands, 300 people there, cheer them, and then they get in the plane and go off again. Because that's the only way you can cover a continent. It suddenly becomes very congested. But these early phases are really where it feels most like a democracy in a sort of very traditional sense, yeah.
And yet, at the end, we might well end up with one billionaire against another. Is that just a function of the cost of modern politics?
To an extent, yes. The system is hard to actually raise all that money. I've never bought the view that being a billionaire is a fundamentally undemocratic act. These are self-made, well, Bloomberg certainly is. Yeah. Trump inherited money, but made more himself, or not, depending on who you believe. But yeah. Bloomberg, no doubt about it. He grew up working class. His fortune is entirely made by himself. And I don't think people see him, perhaps some people see him as an elitist, oligarchist, kind of, but a lot of people see him as a truly successful kind of version of the American dream.
Because I think you once told me he was the guy who literally came around to your desk originally saying, I can't get my computer to start. And he'd go under the desk and sort of fiddle around with it.
Well, it wasn't my computer, but when he started Bloomberg, so his story was he was an investment banker and he got fired in his late 30s, early 40s, and was given a payoff. And with that money, he started Bloomberg. But yes, he was tech support. He would be crawling under traders' desks to fix these things if they didn't work. He was a rich man, but he's a genuine entrepreneur. And people like that. I think when he was mayor of New York, he was very solutions-focused, very pragmatic, very apolitical. And we're going to see if that can work on a national level. It's not clear it will, but there are a lot of people who wish it could.
I think what's so fascinating from a British point of view is watching these ads on TV. I mean, it's very unusual for a Brit to see the television and then see an advertising break and you have about four or five advertisements, all from politicians. No soap powder, no cars, no Advil, you know, just the politicians completely dominating the outways. And one's rather surprised that the ads make such a difference, but that's what all the money is spent on these days. And of course, also on social media, which if you're not American, you probably don't see.
And they're well done, those ads, are they, or are they cheesy?
Some of them are quite good, I think, but they're kind of big picture. They're always kind of sort of romantic, if you like. You know, the man who's going to solve, or the woman who's going to solve all America's problems, and she's just like you, and she understands your problems, etc. So one's rather surprised that they make such a difference, but apparently they do. Bernie Sanders has raised all his money from small donations, but he's raising money at the rate of about $25 million a month at the moment, apparently, which does seem to me absolutely extraordinary.
Extraordinary. And Ivo, your main task here is to write an article for the world's greatest magazine, The Oldie, about the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower landing 400 years ago in November 1620. Do you think it still assumes big significance in American life, the Mayflower?
I think it is deep in the sort of emotional and romantic DNA of Americans. If you think, it's very interesting, Thanksgiving, of course, is such an incredibly important festival in November every year. It was invented by Abraham Lincoln, Thanksgiving. And it was really from a notion that the nation needed to come together at some point. And it's based on a belief that the Mayflower pilgrims did celebrate together with a meal after their first year in America. But I think that sense of arrival is very common to everybody in America, even if they've come from Mexico or they've come from India. It's a sense of America as a destination, the famous shining city upon a hill. And so I think the Mayflower although of course very much not the first colony in America, has this kind of emblematic importance.
And why do you think you're perfectly qualified to talk about this, Philip? Because you are a British man who's arrived in America and lived here. Why is it assumed such significance, given that, as Ivo says, they weren't the first British settlers?
Well, I think it was the religious component. I think it's just one of these events that's gathered a sort of wonderful myth around it. And I think, you know, what's interesting, you know, 400 years on, is that today people look at that and they look at the pilgrims arriving, having this meal with the Native Americans. And for many, many years, this was a symbol of, you know, two cultures meeting, sharing. But I think today, when there's so many assumptions about race and identity and everything being just blown up and exploded and discussed, people look at this and think, well, this was colonization. So even acts that for decades were seen as, you know, the Indians brought the corn and the turkey and they shared this great meal, now it looks as an act of rank naivety because they were essentially opening the door to their own destruction. So I think these events, how they change, you know, the perspective on them changes. And right now we're going through this period, I think it's a remarkable period in which so much of this stuff is under discussion. People look at this anniversary with a whole new sort of filter. In a way they wouldn't have looked at the 350th or the 300th. It would be a completely different perspective on it.
And a related question, here we are in your beautiful house in Litchfield, Connecticut, and you could well be in a little corner of England. All the place names are English. Your local church is a copy of St. Martin in the Fields in Trafalgar Square. You, somebody brought up in Britain, does America feel allied, I don't mean politically, but in sensation to Britain, or do you think there's a very, very different place?
I think of it as a very different place. It's almost no point sort of making these comparisons. Well, yes, Litchfield is a town. We have a T in the middle of Litchfield, unlike the English cathedral town, which has no T. And New England, obviously, this is where we are, this part of America. But I think, you know, America's identity is so unique. And one of the interesting things about this election season, it's like, I remember reading about the Tour de France. How the Tour de France was originally created by Michelin to give a sense of what France was as a single country. Before, it was like lots of different provinces. And French people, through the Tour de France, got to see what France as a nation meant. And I always think election year is a chance when Americans actually get to see what America looks like. Because otherwise, you live so much in your city, your state, your particular identity group. And this time, this one year, as you go from Iowa to California to Oregon to Texas, culminating in November the 5th, when everyone votes on the same day for the same slate of candidates. And it's every 4 years you actually get to see the country as a whole in its kind of uniqueness.
Well, that's a very good place to end the Oldie podcast. I'm very grateful to Ivo Dorney and Philip Del Broughton.